only replies to the staff case might lead to strange results. That's one of the cautions that Mr. Wessel was giving earlier, I think, is that for the numbers we are giving to the numbers we have given, the numbers that anybody will run under Williams will be mechanically applying to Williams' staff. There is reason to believe, strong reason to believe, that when they actually come to TAP, not only on the refund question, but on a number of other questions, they will not mechanically apply Williams, have a large room for discretion to make changes. That was also the concern that we had concerning the commission changing its stripes. Even though this is a reasonable decision, for Lower 48 Pipeline, it was a pro-oil company pipeline. One of the things we did not talk about, Mr. Trump did not talk about concerning the Williams Brothers, the Lower 48 Pipeline, because it doesn't apply to TAP for newer pipelines, is that for Lower 48 Pipeline, they basically gave the company everything they wanted for the past. Gave them the old, crazy, modern valuation up to the point of the date of the decision. And only started the COC from the date of the decision. So for Lower 48 Pipeline, they are still a pro-oil company position, commission, and it's doubtful they can change the stripes. There's plenty of room for maneuvering. So even though we could run all these numbers, there's a danger in attaching way too much importance to them. They give you the lay of the land. They give you some general feeling that, yeah, things are swinging our way, and in fact, for many situations, the settlement may be look worse, but there are cautions to be done. And as to that, I'll just give Bob the question, to maybe that question, one about somebody who's working on my
own. Yeah. Let me go to the capital structure question. In your leisure, I suggest you look at the discussion on page 11 in footnote 45. In the context of gas pipelines, before the Williams decision, but very recently, they adopted as a general policy the use of actual capital structure rather than hypothetical. And they said further that if the subsidiary, the pipeline is a wholly owned subsidiary of the parent, in that case, the actual capital structure would be that of parent. In Williams, they say quite explicitly what they've done is apply the approach for gas pipelines now to oil pipelines. And in the case of TAP, where the parent guaranteed all the debt, is the parent capital structure, with the qualification that you would add to the parent capital structure, debt guaranteed, the pipelines guarantee debt. That's footnote 45. I think what you're getting at, though, is the question, what is the regulatory thinking about capital structure? And that thinking has always been that capital structure, in a sense, related to risk, the risk of the particular enterprise, and that by using the capital structure of the parent, you are blending the risk of various enterprises ranging from oil exploration and development to pipelines to copper companies to departments in the case of some of the staff owners, and it doesn't make sense to use the parent's capital structure because you don't have any measure appropriate to particular enterprise rates are being set. The commission does not deal with that, but indeed speaks about using the parent structure in guarantee situations, perhaps because they also have a preference for not going to the exercise, trying to determine what is the right hypothetical capital structure for the pipeline city. But the opinion is very clear. They can always change their minds as it is clear. As to FERC, there are two vacancies. Commissioners Sheldon and Souza are both beyond the expiration of their term. To my recollection, a nominee has nomination has been made for one of those two vacancies. A name has been mentioned, but not yet nominated, second vacancy. And Commissioner Democrat resigned last week. So there will be another vacancy still. And whenever we've been faced with so many vacancies, tended to look at a period of extra delays that he's done. And it depends how fast White House, the Senate, moves at filling the vacancy.
Okay, Bob, just to follow up on the capital structure question again, are we talking about the capital structure of the parent company for the one project? Like, are we talking about Sohio's parent company capital structure being used to figure the rate base of the Trans-Alaska pipeline, or are we talking about their the specific project financing terms?
About the former, the overall capital structure of the parent company, and probably a question is, as of what time, and for fixing starting rate base, the commission talks about, as of the date of this decision, that it would seem that that would not be appropriate on tap. You would go back. Well, you might, but I don't know, but I can only refer you to that footnote 44. But if, to answer the question again, yes, it's the parent's overall capital structure, not related to the specific finance terms of pipeline funding.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. You said that there's two vacancies. There is five commissioners, is that correct?
Well, out of five, there are actually, I guess, there are three vacancies, right, because of this recent resignation. And there are five commissioners.
So we ought to be able to want to ask him. Volunteer.
Thank you very much. We have, I realize you people have other commitments coming up at 3 o'clock. We have Jamie Love is going to, perhaps I should introduce him to the committee. He's working for the majority caucus. And Jamie, did you have some things that you'd like to share with the committee this time? And if you people would, maybe you could stay on and may have some further questions, at least as long as you can.
We will stay on as long as we can. I want to clarify one thing. There are seats to be filled, but both commissioners, Susan and Sheldon, are staying on a holdover basis until their successors are nominated and confirmed. So there's only one seat that it has no one in it because of Richard's resignation. There's total three seats to be filled.
Thank you, Bob. Go ahead, Jane.
Thank you. Maybe I should start out by saying I spent the last 4 weeks looking at issues involving the past era, and I started looking at the Williams decision, about 10 days ago, something like that. In my department of law, I've been trying to estimate what the tariffs would be under the Williams decision, as opposed to the settlement tariffs, as opposed to what the states, the likely tariffs would be under the state's original negotiating position, and to interpret in reviewing those numbers, to evaluate whether or not the state was better off being a part of the settlement or better off trying to get out of the settlement that's involved in right now. And I'd like to go over some of the points that have already been highlighted by Mr. Leffler and Mr. Maynard and Juneau. As you know from discussions with the Department of Law privately, and I think people in the audience have heard today, the Williams Brothers decision does provide lower tariffs than the settlement through approximately year 1993. After that period, we have higher tariffs. My estimates would be that the tariffs of Williams would be about $2 to $2.50. Higher than the settlement in constant dollars in 1984 dollars in the later part of the 1990s. As you know, the settlement has an option, I believe, in the year 2006. or can be renegotiated. Essentially, the period that the central case or the sort of tariffs that most people are looking at on the Williams case, where the tariffs would be higher than the settlement, sort of 1993 to 2000 period, is a period when the throughput in the pipeline is considerably lower than it is right now. By 1999, the Department of Law estimates the throughput will be less than half what it is today. And they expect a very substantial drop off rapidly after that. So the tariffs in the Williams decisions, it'll be higher than 1990s, will be higher at a time when the state's shipping less oil through the pipeline. That's one thing I think that is important to think about in evaluating what the Williams decision might mean for the state of Alaska. The second issue is that the mix of oil coming through the pipeline in the 1990s and after the year 2000 is likely to be more and more federal oil that's offshore, and that's oil the state does not have the power to tax or does not own royalties to. And so the amount of money that the state has at stake, or the interest the state has in oil that's shipped from federal offshore land, will be different than the interest we have with land that's shipped over the next 10 years, which is primarily state oil, or oil that's from state leases. Another aspect is that there are some leases where oil will come over the pipeline in the 1990s that were leased under the net profit share leasing method, where the marginal benefit to the state of a lower tariff is actually quite a bit higher than the amount you get under the normal low bonus, low royalty bonus bidding system. There are some leases, for example, that Ohio is holding in the north of the Duck Island unit that have a net profit share as high as 70%. They're considered leases to go into development. So a high tariff on those leases would represent a substantial loss to the state for the dollars that are involved for each barrel that was shipped through the pipeline from those particular leases. On balance, though, I think it's probably true, and I think it's important that the state of Alaska has a good handle on this, as already been suggested, that we know what our calculations are and our interest in the tariff, how much on the dollar the state's revenue depends on the tariff in the different periods. I'd like to say a few things about the Williams decision. I agree with the Department of Law. It's a very pro-company decision. In fact, if you read the remand on the Williams case from 1984, you'd be hard-pressed to find as many directions that the FERC could have gone that would have been more to the interest of the oil pipeline companies than what they did in the FERC decision. Despite the fact that it is in almost every conceivable case that appears to be allowable under the standards set by the appeals court, we still find that it performs better in most simulations that I've run and the Department of Law has run than the settlement the state has entered into. And you have to ask yourself if that's the case, what type of downside risk we thought was out there since the District Circuit Court remand was publicly available in 1984. I think that another point that should be made is that the Williams decision is not necessarily the standard that would be applied to the state of Alaska in the Cass case, and I think almost all alternatives to the Williams decision that are sustainable in court are probably far better for the state than the Williams decision. The part of the Williams decision which is bad for the state of Alaska is that it's one of the major considerations is that they trimmed the rate base, which has one major flaw from the state's perspective, and that is that they also, in doing that, increased the allowance for depreciation by the rate of inflation for the portion of the rate base that's considered the equity portion. That results in higher federal income tax payments under the Williams Brothers case than under a depreciated original cost method of somewhere in the neighborhood around $10 billion over the period that everyone's been looking at. And that's one of the reasons why the Williams Brothers decision is only marginally better than the settlement, is because the income tax distortion, which is caused from the fact that the new pipelines to compete with old pipelines. On the North Slope, you have a situation where there's just going to be one pipeline. It's not an issue of competition between new pipelines, but more important, you have a profile of production, which is very high in the early years and very low in the later years of the pipeline operation. So a pipeline which is trended, rather than giving a level tariff, will tend to give a tariff which accelerates as the production in North Slope falls off. And for that reason, and perhaps for that reason alone, in the public interest in developing the North Slope, I think the state should have an excellent chance before the FERC of distinguishing the TAP situation with the lower 48 situation. Now our council can advise the committee as to what they think the probability of winning at some point in the litigation with the appreciated original cost settlement on TAPs. I know that in the June 18th hearings before the House, the state had suggested in discussions with members of Congress that they felt the state had a better than 50% chance of prevailing in its litigation position. And the tariffs under the appreciated original cost case will actually be lower than the settlement tariffs in the 1990s, and will actually be lower than the settlement tariffs in the year 2000. So I think the proper interpretation of the Williams decision for this committee is that it's essentially the downside risk to the state in terms of the outcome of the pipeline litigation. It's probably a better outcome than the settlement outcome and a most reasonable settlement under most reasonable simulations. And it's certainly, there's certainly a substantial possibility the state will do much better than the Williams case if it continues to litigate. If you would like, I'd be willing to over some detail on the numbers, but those were the initial observations I wanted to offer.
That's it for
sure. Thank you, Jamie. I just had one clarification. When you had talked about the higher tariffs being $2.50 in the late 1990s, at a time when throughput would be in half, we've always talked rule of thumb about $1 a barrel.
What share of the throughput on the pipeline, what stake do you have in the tariff? Right now it's a little over 25 cents a barrel, I think. You have to estimate that for the period. The second thing is how much oil is shipping. If you're shipping half as much oil, then you'd have to cut the million and a half figure in half just on the basis of that before you make any other adjustments. So I think it's probably in the neighborhood of, at the current share, or in the neighborhood of 100 and a quarter, 150 million for most years. That's in the $1,984.
Jamie, I think the other committee would be interested in going over some of the detailed information that you've generated. We have some time to do that right now. We do have several members of the public that are interested in this appointment. Go right ahead.
The members of the committee have these exhibits that are in the back of the package. They start with, should I give you a copy of this?
Sure. If there's anybody in the public that would like to have that. And Rose Ann Marula, like I said, with a lot of this material we just gathered this morning, and we'll try to keep in mind that you're out on the other end of the line and you don't have access to this.
I appreciate that, Mr. Johnson.
I'd first like to state for everybody that this is about the third draft of these numbers I put through in the past 3 days, and I did spend about an hour or a half hour in the morning on the phone this morning to Tom Horst, who works for the Department of Law on the TAPS issue, and I will probably be revising these figures the next 2 days based on those discussions. But I still think it would probably be helpful to run through these numbers. The first page is an exhibit titled Refunds to the State. In here, I list the what's called a TSM throughput is the throughput that's used in the state's, in the version I have of the state's cap settlement methodology. These are just historical numbers through 1985, at least through 1984. And in the other exhibits, you'll see that they have estimates for the year 2011.
Where do those numbers come from?
The Department of Law, I believe, worked with the Division of Petroleum Revenue on the throughput estimates, but they may have also consulted with some other state agencies. I took them right off the TAF settlement program with the listing that I had. That's correct. The Department of Law uses the column titled "Recovery" is the percentage of each dollar in tariff that the state expects to receive on settlements. You'll notice it's zero for 1977 because that's a year when the tariffs that were actually filed were less than the cost. Everyone has. That's partly because I think the pipeline was down for a few months, and there wasn't much throughput in that year. The next year,
what is this number again now?
The recovery is the cents on the dollar that the state gets from reductions in tariffs for those years. So a figure of 0.256 would say that the state would get 25.6 cents on the dollar for every dollar reduction in the tariff. And you'd multiply that times the number of barrels that were shipped, which is the throughput column. And then you'd multiply that again by the next column, which is called the interest gross-up. And this column is designed to take into account the fact that the companies have to pay interest on refunds. Now, according to the Department of Law, I'm going to have to revise the interest gross-up figures, but substantially, this it's not going to change that much. The basic idea is that when you have a refund that's 7 or 8 years old, you're going to get a lot more than the amount of the original refund in 1985 due to the interest requirements. Under the tariffs, I have the actual tariffs as reported to me by the Department of Revenue. The TSM is the TAF settlement methodology. That's the settlement tariff. And then you have my estimates for the Williams decision, and two versions of the depreciated original cost tariffs, which are essentially what I take the state's litigation position to be. I take the state's litigation position to be something close to the 75-25 version of the DOC. That would be 75% debt, 25% equity. I view a more likely outcome, should the state prevail in a depreciated original cost case, to be the 60-40 outcome, which is the approximate capital structure you find in many regulated industries, including the gas pipeline industry. Then the refunds is just a question of subtracting the actual tariff from the tariff under the different methodologies and multiplying that times the throughput, the recovery figure, and the interest gross-up figure. Now, in these versions, I have refunds in Williams of about $3 billion in 1985. Now, and I talked to Department of Law this morning. We tried to go over some of our differences in our numbers, and we're actually not that far apart, around 1985 to 1983. But in the 78 to 81 period, I think that we're somewhat different. And the Department of Law thinks it's because of some differences of the way we treated deferred taxes and in those years. And so if I make the adjustments suggested by the Department of Law, that would adjust my numbers down. I think the numbers probably could also be discounted somewhat more if someone took into consideration the probability that the problems they might have inflicted the charter oil company on those refunds. But basically, I think that most people would agree that you're talking about a figure that's somewhere between $2 to $3 billion. I think that Department of Law would put it closer to two, probably. I'd probably put it, I'll have to make their suggested changes before I can recalculate this for you.
So we're looking, Jamie, if I could interrupt, and on the first page then, we're looking at the TSM, or the, in other words, the settlement at around $300 million, and then according to the Williams brothers, and or the appreciated original cost, somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 to $3 billion. Is that correct?
That's correct. The second exhibit is called the CAF settlement compared to possible FERC outcomes 1986 and the year 2006. I should start right here by saying that there's a fundamental flaw in the way I've calculated these things, and that I have used a 4.2% inflation rate for the three tariffs that I calculated, and the Department of Law used a varying degree of inflation, which it turns out in those later years bounces around between 5 and I think 6.8% or something. And so I'm going to have to recalculate my tariffs using the same inflation rate they used to make a more accurate comparison of the tariffs. But in general, as you can see, in 1983, the Williams Brothers tariffs are higher than the tariffs under the TAP settlement methodology. That is the same year that the Department of Law estimates that the Williams Brothers tariffs become higher than the TAP settlement methodology. When I calculated the 1984 dollars in the middle columns, if you read across, you can see that there is approximately a $1.50 to $2.50 difference between the Williams Brothers tariffs and the TAP settlement methodology tariffs for the late 1990s. You also notice that the TAP settlement methodology tariffs are generally higher than the tariffs you would see under depreciated original cost settlement. And in discussions with the Department of Law, I think that it's my understanding that in their simulations, the TAP settlement methodology tariffs tend to be somewhat higher, perhaps in the 40 to 50 cent range. I'm not exactly sure, but somewhat higher than their possible outcomes under a DOC type settlement, a depreciated original cost settlement. So, in that sense, the depreciated original cost tariffs would be lower in the front end, and they would also be lower in the low end in the TAP settlement methodology. So, there would not be a trade-off of the present versus the future if we could prevail on the appreciated original cost rate-making methodology. The next three exhibits are the actual, next four exhibits are the actual worksheets that I use to calculate the tariffs in the four cases listed here. I've done several others, are the Williams case with a 47% debt, 53% equity capital structure. The Williams calculated with 60% debt, 40% equity. And the two DOC settlements, one at 60-40 and one at 75-25. The reason why the debt component is so important is because for people who calculate these things, become familiar with real quick, the when a rate of return is allowed on equity, it's not only usually higher than the rate of return on debt, but you're allowed to get approximately twice as much in a gross figure, because you're allowed to you're given allowance for income taxes, and when you have a debt structure that is heavily weighted toward equity, which the Williams decision is, it allows for tariffs that are far higher than you would get if you use the capital structure that oil companies actually used in financing the TAPS pipeline, which was approximately 85% debt. I think I'd like to stop here and ask any further questions about these exhibits. Any questions?
any questions from members of the committee?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I apologize, but as you know, this is the start of the
Certainly, given the time frame, go right ahead, Bob. You should have said this earlier, but you should identify who's talking, just so this tape is being transcribed, they're going to wonder which Bob it is.
Bob Mays, I apologize, Jim. Generally, we have a couple of comments that the left will make. I would note that we believe Mr. Love has done an excellent job of having come to grips with this, even though there are a number of we believe different assumptions or perhaps errors in what's done, got to realize extremely complex, extremely a lot of assumptions have to be full of the confidence of our mind.
Exercise I currently do.
case, and with the experience of the commission, we see a lot of things that we cannot discuss publicly. I just can't say anything more than that. But we try to do the best we can in estimating, and I emphasize again that there was, to me, a surprising degree of anonymity on our side of the case as to what the chances were for better or worse.
Tom Horst has a brief comment, then we'll be glad to take any questions before we leave. And again, I apologize to the committee for not being able to stay for the full course.
Yeah, I'd just like to comment generally on the exercise of protecting what Williams set up would be and therefore what revenues they would be under Williams' methodology. There's a lot of uncertainty in there relating to issues like the rate of return on the rate base, like the question is whether or not the pipeline series could be recapitalized for tax purposes, issues relating to deferred taxes, issues relating to how the provision for dismantling and removal, restoration of the right-of-way would be handled. Mr. Lesler made the point earlier that you can apply Williams, mechanically apply Williams using what I might call plausible worst-case assumptions and easily come up with a result that is worse for the state that the settlement is. And it's not only worse for the state, but that you get the crossover between Williams' tariff versus settlement tariff much earlier than 1993. I think the only point to keep in mind is don't attach too much weight to any one set of Williams numbers, because they are the product of a long series of assumptions which all experts, I think, when they sit down and look at it, may disagree on. I mean, all that notwithstanding, I think we share the overall perception that the Williams decision seems to be a favorable decision to the state, seems to be favorable largely because of the low tariffs that it provides on the front end, and that those tariffs are low enough to offset the disadvantages of the high tariff on the back end. Not a particularly pro-development decision, but in dollar terms, it looks like on the whole it needs to be.
Tom, thank you. We have two questions here, one from Representative Samansky, and we have Representative Pingalberry, and I'll inform them again that you have just a few minutes. But go ahead. Right ahead.
Thank you very much. A couple questions right quick before you leave. The 19th deadline associated with the comment period, has the state formally drafted comments at this time?
That the first shot at the comments goes to the people other than the signatories to the agreement. Traditionally, we take the reply round, so it's 10 days from the 19th when we would file comments. We've done some work, but I don't think we have a complete draft yet, and we have till the end of the month, please.
I'm a little confused in that. I guess my understanding was that the 19th, or 18th is still a cutoff period for comments, direct comments associated with it. Are you saying only affected parties have that cutoff date?
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that there are two rounds of comments, the comments and the reply comments. The people who are not parties to the settlement comment at the first date, and then at least the sponsors or signatories to the settlement comment at the second date.
Okay. I guess the question maybe to Maynard on this is that it seems to me that based on the evidence or the testimony that we received to date and the information we received in the last week, at least I, as a committee member of this committee, am going to be suggesting and strongly encouraging, in conjunction with what I've heard from other members, that we do comment. Could Maynard, you intervene at this time to extend the comment period on behalf of the state, and would you support such a motion based on a request from the committee?
The problem is
we have, the judge's ruling right now that any extensions of time must be accompanied by an extension of drop-dead date, which is now November 30th. That's a tactical question. I'm not prepared to comment upon publicly right now. I'll be glad to talk to you about it at any time.
Okay. I just want to, you're going to be leaving the net, and I am going to, in conjunction with Representative Cotton and hopefully Penalbury's support associated with the questions and comments that he had made earlier, are going to be making a motion to take some action by the committee. But it's going to be related to our ability to comment, so what we'll do is try to set up a conference with you shortly, next couple of days, maybe tomorrow, through staff to determine exactly how we procedurally can move on that. But I just encourage you, if you're deliberating on it the next few hours, my inclination is that the committee is definitely and must take action to at least from a policy-making perspective, reconfirm or at least put out where we, the legislature, are at this time with regard to the settlement and or the impact of the Williams Brothers decision. And I think it just behooves us to move as expeditiously as possible to get an extension of it. So we'll just deal with it in the next 24 hours.
Representative Alden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I ask my last question, I do want to tell Mr. Horst and Mr. Leffler and Mr. Maynard that when I go to bed at night and I count my blessings, one of the blessings I count is that the state is in very good hands of the way these gentlemen have been proceeding with the case. And this committee has been following it since very early in the year. We've had more hearings and more meetings on this subject than I think any other subject that's come before the committee. Certainly, Mr. Leffler and Mr. Maynard and Mr. Horst have been very forthcoming with the information and instruction they've given us. And I just want to be on record saying thank you. Now I'm going to ask a question that might, if I didn't say what I just said, you might misinterpret. The statistics I asked you for before, and for curves, I heard two of you say, throw great flags of caution, that we don't want to put too much weight into any numbers on the Williams scenario because they're so tentative. There are so many variables that could change that we don't want to pin our hopes on any particular set of numbers. No. I think we understand that. And I think that when you run these numbers, and I do hope, Bob, that you'll undertake to get the curves that I asked for from the Department of Revenue, but I think you just list, you put note, what all the variables are that you know about. There might be some that will come up that you won't know about. And so when the changes do come, we'll be able to just refer to your footnote. The process, and the reason I think it's important, the process by which we understand this issue is for us to go through the numbers, understand that there are variables and that some of them have greater risk factors associated than others. But you know, we've got to have that or we don't really understand, or I'll say I don't really understand the dynamics of the case we're dealing with. So don't worry about us pinning our hopes on the numbers. I want to keep having those numbers in front of me so that the situation changes, I can track the numbers and understand the mechanics of the issue. That's all. Thank you.
We understand, Representative Gallagher, and we didn't mean to say that those numbers wouldn't be helpful at all. They certainly give direction. They certainly assist in analyzing the process. But I will be glad to what you ask.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We do have to leave, and I apologize for this debate.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. We appreciate all the information, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you again soon. This meeting was set up as a work session. There is several members of the public that would like to make some comments, and I'd like to open that up for members of the public who would like to come forward. We have two people on our sign-up sheet. One is Evan Goldstein. Please state your name for the record. Just hand who you represent.
My name is Evan Goodstein, and I represent the Alaska Public Interest Research Group. We're a statewide organization of over 600 members concerned with consumer and public policy issues. I'd like to give a brief prepared statement, and then if you have any questions about it, please feel free to ask me. outstanding involvement with the TAPS case, and we are currently interveners in the case with the charge to represent the interests of Alaska citizens at large. I'd like to thank you for giving me the opportunity to express our views on this important matter. Our basic concern about the proposed settlement is that the state of Alaska is giving up too much in exchange for too little. What we are giving up is well known, somewhere between $2 and $3 billion in refunds. What are we gaining? First, lower future tariffs, and second, the certainty of a settlement. In general, ACPERC supports the notion of lower future tariffs, but we must not overemphasize their value, particularly when we may get